prophet and evangelist John the Baptist, has been executed by Herod. Listen now for the unfolding story of God's great love made manifest. Now, when Jesus heard about John's death and burial, he withdrew from there in a boat to a deserted place by himself. But when the crowds heard it, they followed him on foot from the towns. When he went ashore, he saw a great crowd, and he had compassion for them and cured their sick. When it was evening, the disciples came to him and said, "This is a deserted place, and the hour is now late. Send the crowds away so that they may go into the villages and buy food for themselves." Jesus said to them, "They need not go away. You give them something to eat." They replied, "We have nothing here but 5 loaves and 2 fish. And he said, "Bring them here to me." Then he ordered the crowds to sit down on the grass. Taking the 5 loaves and 2 fish, he looked up to heaven and blessed and broke the loaves and gave them to the disciples, and the disciples gave them to the crowds. And all ate and were filled, and they took up what was left over of the broken pieces, 12 baskets full. And those who ate were about 5,000 men, besides women and children. This is the good news for today. Let us rejoice and be glad in it.
Good morning, Brent.
Good morning.
Good morning, everyone. Good morning. Jesus is said to have made this statement: "I will open my mouth and tell stories." This is a phrase that the writer of the Gospel of Matthew plucks out of the Psalms, out of Psalm 78, and uses in the Gospel to explain how Jesus taught, how Jesus preached about God's love. "I will open my mouth and tell stories." Among the many roles that Jesus played in the life of his followers, he was first and foremost a storyteller. In fact, Matthew said he didn't say anything to them without using a story. As people of Christian faith, we believe that we hear and know God through all of the stories in the Bible. So this has become one of my mottos as a minister: I will open my mouth and I'll tell stories.
I love it. Well, we Christians have sometimes been called the people of the book. I think more accurately and truthfully, we should be called the people of the story that this book tells and the story and word that this book points to. I have to tell you, as much as I love preparing for sermons by geeking out on my commentaries, as much as I love reading deep resources, as much as I love the theology behind it all, every time I think about my interactions with you or the life of this church, every time I work on a sermon like this, I try to remind myself of the importance of story. Roger Shin describes our story as a dance that exists in two parts to that story. One is the greater story, the story of God's ongoing act in creation, in revelation, and working in and amongst us as people of faith. And that joins with the dance of what Shin calls the lesser story, the story of places like this one, little churches spread throughout the world doing their best to live into being church and telling the stories not just in this room, but in our lives. I think story matters for 3 important reasons. First, when we remember that this is a story that we just heard from Steve, it ought to immediately defy our tendency to want to capture or pin that story down to mean any one particular thing, because we all know that the stories of our lives mean different things at different times of our lives. stories I think evoke. Fred Craddock tells people like you and me, preachers, that we should be reading all kinds of secular stories, that we should be reading them to enrich our vocabulary, to enrich our sense of storytelling, to enrich our engagement with the world, so that when we open our mouths, we simply tell stories. Second, I think good stories told well reach beyond themselves to truths that are enduring. You don't know this, but one of my touchstones that I've shared with my congregation in my work of faith is Dostoevsky's work, The Brothers Karamazov. And in it, I think what he's communicating in that story is that we, the church, are doomed to fail at some level in our attempt to commune with and understand the divine. But instead, Dostoevsky remembers that we should always keep grasping the story to get what's behind it, to the unfolding truths that are there. And finally, I think stories are important because the best stories invite us to take a stand in the midst of those stories. If you read a great story like All the Light We Cannot See, you cannot help but be transported there to World War II France, to feel not just that you are reading the story, but that you are there with it. And so this morning's story with the feeding of the 5,000, well, not to mention the women and children, we're not invited just to listen and watch, but rather, like Tanglewood, to bring our blankets and to join the great crowd waiting for that feast. So I, too, will open my mouth and tell stories.
One of the things, Brent, that you and I have talked about as we've prepared to work together on Christian formation here at Stockbridge Church is, what do we know about learning? What do we know about teaching? And I think the thing that fascinates me about teaching is how stories affect us. What actually happens when we hear a story? And I've learned that stories, in particular, stimulate areas in our brains in a different way than just giving facts do. I think I see that on Sunday mornings when I preach. When I'm giving facts, y'all just kind of glaze. There's like, I'm thinking of other things. But as soon as a story happens, we connect with it. So when we tell a child a story, if we invite that child to imagine the salty ocean breeze, that stimulates the part of the brain that knows and remembers smell. If we suggest to that child what it might be like to move through a crowd, remember 5,000 plus and they're probably this big and the crowd is of adults, what it's like to move through that crowd to get closer to Jesus, the motor cortex area of that brain, that child's brain, lights up. So it affects us in physical ways. Some research that I found even says that if a story, this is what it says, if a story is capable of creating attention that sustains interest, think of your favorite shows on television, you're gonna turn it back on because you have to know what happens, right? It's more likely, if that tension happens, it's more likely that, quote, attentive listeners will come to share the emotions of the characters in it, and after it ends, likely to continue mimicking the feelings and the behaviors of those characters. So it's important what kind of stories we're telling, right? It's important what characters we're sharing with our kids. Even the youngest child can imagine what it might be like to be that small boy who has to make a decision to share his meager meal of fish and loaves. And in the tension of that moment, in the tension of his making that decision, perhaps our children will see themselves and wonder if they too can participate in a miracle of God.
Love it. And you know, Jesus says a couple of chapters later in Matthew, he says to all of you, unless you change, unless you become like one of those children, one of those children who wants to wriggle in the middle of the story, one of the children who wants to become a part of it all and figure out how they play, unless you become like that child, we will not see the kingdom of heaven. I often find in Bible studies that adults sometimes instead take a story like this, they want to pick it apart. They want to dissect it. They want to understand it and do all of it, hopefully, at arm's length. Sometimes as adults, I think before we believe something, and by that use of believe, you know I mean the kind of believing that you give your heart and your life to, before you could really let something change who you are and who you follow. Far too often, unfortunately, we first have to cognitively believe it. Unless we get it up here, sometimes that gets in the way of us getting it down here, unlike children who will jump into the middle of the story and run with it. How did that bread and fish multiply? And over the years, there have been tons of stories of exactly how that happened. Some say, Jesus just did it. Get over it. Other times, there's the explanation that the generosity of this boy sharing prompted everyone else to share, and so the food just multiplied. There are endless theories. But that isn't the focus of Matthew's story. He doesn't ever focus in this story about how it happened. Some of you have heard me tell this story before. But a good friend of mine, Jennifer, who's a pastor, went to the Pacific School of Religion in Berkeley, and they always marched in the Pride Parade in San Francisco. And before they marched as a contingent of students and faculty, they shared communion together. Now, the dean will tell you that on this particular year, the parade started early. Jennifer would tell you he was just prattling on like he always did. But they hadn't yet shared communion, and the parade was starting. And so the dean, thinking quickly on his feet, decided they would serve communion to that small contingent before they got to the parade. Well, it took too long, and so they were already into the parade and still sharing communion. And since this was a pride parade, the relationship between the people, the LGBT community, and the church is somewhat difficult, a young woman came running up to the edge with tears in her eyes and said she hadn't been to church in a decade because her church had kicked her out. She would give anything to share a piece of that bread. And they tell the story of how they kept walking, and before they knew it, they were besieged on all sides by people who wanted a tiny taste of that bread and a sip of that cup. And Jennifer will tell you this, they marched for 3 miles, and by the end of it, they had fed everybody who wanted it, and what she would say at the end of it is she has no idea how it happened, but that the bread simply kept appearing, the cup kept getting refilled, and together, all of them made sure that anyone who was hungry was fed. Stories don't always necessarily care as much about the how as the what and the why.
Well, we could just end right there. That's an amazing story. What a powerful story, the power of God. And it's clear to me from listening to you tell this story that you have some understanding of what it means to tell a story and to know your audience in telling it. And I think that Jesus knew that. I think that Jesus instinctively knew what it meant to know who he was talking to. The way that he described things, the references he made, the idioms he used, they clearly knew something about the listener. As I think they should, you know, depends on your listener, how you're going to explain something. It depends on their education. It depends on their race, their religion. It depends on so many things: their cognitive ability, their emotional ability, their physical maturation. I think all of those things play a part in how we make sense of the stories we hear. So when we approach teaching our children, which is obviously of importance to me, when we talk about our kids and these stories of the Bible, it's important to know that audience. For example, if I'm going to tell this story to kids from birth to maybe 6 years of age, I'm going to use very simple language, very descriptive language, sensory based, like I said earlier, the salty breeze. I might use rhythm, repetition, a song to help solidify the idea. Of course, this helps all of us, right? But with that age range in particular, that's important. Now, if I'm going to tell the story to kids maybe 6 or 7 through maybe 10, these kids are just beginning to grasp the idea of values, of what's important in their life. Anybody have any kids in that range? 7 to 10? Yeah. They're thinking about what's important. Sometimes it's really strange stuff they come up with, but it's what's important in their lives. So I might emphasize with that group how the boy with the fish and the loaves had to make a decision about whether or not to share. And then we'll practice some critical thinking together, which they're also just starting to do. So maybe we would ask, why would he share? And why was he the only one with food? And what would I do if I were in that situation? Now, the last group, age group I want to talk about is my favorite, adolescence. I love adolescence. I didn't like my own adolescence, but I love adolescent people. And I would invite their beautiful, irreverent criticism of everything. I love working with them because I love to shock them by saying, yes, question that. Why? Why this story? How in the world can there have been something like this? How could it have happened? Did it happen? What if it didn't happen? What does that mean? I might ask them, why would the gospel writer want to paint this picture of Jesus as a person capable of miracles? I might ask them, is there a modern equivalency in your life, in our lives? Knowing our listeners, right? How they hear it and how we tell it makes a difference.
Nora Tubbs Tisdale talks about preaching in a particular way, but I think it applies to everything, and that is preaching as a local folk art. In other words, that you need to know your congregation in order to tap into their values. And I think one of the things this story does for adults is it gives us a glimpse into who just this Jesus is that we are following. You need to know that on this particular day, Jesus had just found out that his relative, somebody he cared about greatly, John the Baptist, had just been beheaded. He is grieving. He is mourning. He wanted to be by himself, for God's sake. That's why he went out into the middle of nowhere. So Jesus was in the midst of grief, and there was not just a small problem, but a huge problem to be solved. He could have immediately simply dismissed the people and said, you know what, I got enough on my mind. You go out and figure it out. He could have turned to his disciples and said, I've been working with you guys now for a couple of years. Surely you get this by now. You go do something about it. He could have whipped them up into a great frenzy and unleashed them on the power of Rome to finally bring about the kingdom. Or he could have done what the devil, Matthew said, wanted him to do all along, which was to put on a great show for all the people. In this moment, Jesus was fully human. And yet he made a choice, I think, that means it's the kind of choice you and I are supposed to make. He didn't do any of those things. Instead, he simply sat with them and made sure that they were fed. In the midst of this miracle, we see a fully human Jesus who invites us into living in that way. After all, our calling, the thing Jesus asks us to do in remembrance of him, the thing we will say when we feed each other around this table, is to do this in remembrance of me. We put ourselves into this story, both in this room and in all that we do beyond it.
Mm. Brent, do you know the author Frederick Buechner?
I do.
One of my favorite authors. And he says this about the Bible, about this story that we're discussing, that we're thinking about together. He says this: the Bible is a book about both the sublime and the unspeakable. It is a book also about life and the way it really is. It is a book about people who at one and the same time can be both believing and unbelieving, innocent and guilty, crusaders and crooks, full of hope and full of despair. In other words, says Buechner, it is a book about us. And it's this book about us that, ironically enough, shows us the light of God, shows us where we connect in the story that is God's story. And those stories of the Bible then become companions for us along our life's journey. I think this is what it means to be people of the story.
Amen.
Amen.